Best-selling author Kiese Layman grew up in Jackson, Mississippi. His award-winning memoir, Heavy, along with the recently re-released novel, Long Division, and his essay collection, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America, dive deep into the heart of what makes up Black Southern American identity. His genre-bending work is a meditation on race, gender, and coming of age in the American South. Author, professor of English and creative writing at Rice University, and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, Kiese Layman, I want to thank you for joining me on Upfront.
I'm so happy to be here with y'all. Thank you.
Your writing often centers around the ideas of not just revisiting the past, but also this process of what you call revision. Yet we live at a time when laws are being passed that prevent Americans not just from correcting their history, but from even acknowledging history, even witnessing history. Teachers in some parts of the country are being prevented from teaching facts about the country. Historical books are being banned. Literature is being banned. In fact, there was a recent report by the nonprofit organization PEN America that stated that more than 1,600 book titles were banned in schools from 2021 to 2022. Even your own book, Heavy, was banned by a Missouri school district. What do you make of that? And particularly, like, how important is it for us to live in an environment where we do have access to ideas, we do have access to literature, we do have access to history?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I mean, I think it's... I don't think there's anything more important except direct organizing in the face of people who don't want us to look back, who don't want us to direct organize, who don't want us to care, particularly if you look at the Deep South. You know, what we have is, like, again, like, in terms of percentage, like, the blackest place in the nation. I think the place with the highest, concentrated, like, direct action organizing happening. And what we really just have is, we just honestly, in Mississippi, for example, we just need 22% of white people to not to not be Republican. We need 22% because we're 38% of the population. And, you know, those of us who have been incarcerated and those of us who cannot vote should need to be able to vote. But in the absence of voting, what we've always done in the South is we've always done direct action. That direct action was predicated on doing what the state did not want us to do, which is to look back with accuracy, with acuity, and then make a direct action based on what we actually see. It's hard to do that. It's hard to do that now with the nation, politicians, social media, and everything convincing us that that which we saw and know, we do not see or know.
There's also the question of coming to terms with our history. There's this way that, you know, texts that are wrestling with history, revising history, challenging history, are being banned as well. Are these bans an attempt to erase American history, ultimately?
I think the attempts are bans, I think the bans are attempts to erase American history, but I think one way you erase American history historically in the Deep South is you punish the people who are attempting to get folk to watch and look a different way. And so what I see much more than, like, you know, like let's whitewash American history, what I see is let's discipline those folk who do not want to see American present, American past, or American future is anything other than white, cis, Christian, and nationalist. And so, like, I'm under no illusions. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm writing books that white, Christian, nationalists do not like or love. And the hard part of doing that work is not centering those people who make the writing of those books so hard. We talked about this before, Mark. You know, when I'm writing to you. I'm writing to your kids. I'm writing to your partner. I'm writing to the communities that made you, with an acknowledgement that there are other communities that do not care about any of our communities watching. But I cannot center that community and do the work that I think I've been called to do from the Deep South. I've got to, like, look at the abundant parts of you, look at the lacking parts of you and myself, and try to create art in response to that. But I just want to say it's really hard when the power of your state and the power of your region is disciplining you for doing what they actually told you to do as a young child, which was to look to reading and writing for some kind of quote-unquote salvation.
That South that you're talking about, that region, has been disciplining and punishing for a long time. You've written about this extensively. The focal point of U.S. history in many ways is the U.S. South, specifically when we talk about race and the legacy of slavery. The racial disparities, the systemic inequality in the region, they're all rooted in Jim Crow. They're rooted in slavery. They're rooted in these moments before and after Reconstruction. Can you explain, particularly to our international audience, sort of how that legacy plays out today? What is that through line from enslaved Africans coming here to now? You don't have to give me the whole history as much as sort of how that right. legacy plays out now.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of ways to look at the legacy, but I'll just look now at healthcare, right? One of the things, as you know, like I'm incredibly critical of anybody who occupies the seat of empire, which is the presidency of the United States. I was critical of Obama, president of all Clintons, president, critical of Trump, Bush, blah, 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 blah. But what we see in our nation is that, like, these particular states, often led by governors, you know, pushing states' rights, do a number of things throughout history. Some like say, you know, this particular group of people don't have the right to vote. Some say this particular group of people who happen to be black, you know, can't use a bathroom. Some say this particular group of people who happen to be black can't get the benefit that they deserve after going to serve and fight for the country. One of the things you see in my state that is destroying my state now is that Mississippi, the state that is last in damn near every metric you can think of that comes to healthcare, refused the Medicaid, Medicare expansion, which means that half of our hospitals in Mississippi are about to close because they're about to close. And those hospitals, of course, spend most of their times, a lot of their times, a disproportionate amount of their times helping poor black people. But they also spend the other amount of their time helping poor white people. So what's happening in my state is literally the hospitals that the poorest people in the state who are indigenous, white, and black need the most are about to close. And at the end of the day, because a governor elected by residents of Mississippi and a House of Representatives did not want to accept what they called Obamacare, which would have helped all of their people, all of the people who vote for them, the poor white people who vote for them, would have had hospitals. They're about to close. You read a lot about during COVID. You know, my grandmother was one of the people who went to the hospital. Her intestines were like turned around. She could not be seen by anyone because there were no hospital beds to be seen, which took my grandmother back. You know, we talk about time travel and my work. That took my grandmother back to 1952 when she was outside of a hospital in Scott County, Mississippi, and she would not be let in because of her race and gender. So, I just think it's important that we understand that, you know, the past is the past. We need to continually revisit it, or we're going to – and or we are going to relive it. But at the other side, I think we have to understand the draconian, deathly measures being made by governors like Tate Reeves, House of Representatives like the people of Mississippi, the Republicans of Mississippi – and most importantly, the voters who vote these people in to do exactly what they're doing. Voters in Mississippi, voters in Alabama, voters in the Deep South, white Christian nationalist voters are voting politicians in to hurt and harm other poor white people, which will ineffectively hurt black people.
You talk about your grandmother, and I think about your interactions with your grandmother on this question of forgiveness. You asked your grandmother why she shows so much kindness toward people. And she replied, God says you must forgive them for they know not what they do. You said back to her, loving white supremacists in the face of white supremacy is a hallmark of American evil. Now, the context of this dialogue was a piece you wrote about the Charleston massacre where Dylan Roof enters a church and kills nine mm-hmm. black people in worship. Mm-hmm. You talk about how the teaching of forgiveness in black churches can actually grow into a kind of shame that black people carry with them, and it functions as a way of kind of absolving white people of responsibility for their actions. Talk to me a little bit about what that means, about this concept of forgiveness, and what the possibilities are for it.
I love that question, and I'll try to be brief. You know, whenever there have been mass shootings and mass massacres of black people, or mass public massacres of black people in this nation, since my grandmother, since I've been alive and long enough to understand my grandmother, she's always put on this sort of costume of presidentialness when it happens. You know, when you talk to her, you might as well be talking to a president, because the grandmother who existed before this spectacular violence was a completely different one. When Charleston happened, my grandmother kept talking things. She said, Key, you know not what they know not what they do. And part of what she's doing is doing this is that mess she talked about. She's trying to like calm me down, even though I'm a grown man at the time. Her hope is that I won't go out there and put myself and my body and my head and my heart in any sort of space that could get obliterated and destroyed. So when she's like, they know not what they do, she's not. She knows. She more than anybody in this country. My grandmother knows the white people know exactly what they are doing. She. How do I know that? Because she has told me that. But after Charleston, do you know, after Buffalo, You know, after so many murders that have happened in my state and disappearances, my grandmother has to put on the presidential sort of costume of talking to her grandson about how you cannot be too angry, son, because a too angry black person, particularly a too angry black boy, does not live to be an alive black man. So that's what I'm trying to also say in that piece, is that like she's not really, really forgiving. She's taking some of what she has heard from the church, and she's wrapping that around this sort of like understanding that like it's ignorance that has really gotten these white Christian nationalists to do what they do. I'm fully aware, Grandmama, of the 90% of the things you've told me about white Christian nationalists, that they will do everything they can to destroy us no matter what. But in the midst, she has to put on another costume of taking care of her grandson, walking him away from what she would call a cliff, and actually lying. That's a conflict, but I think that conflict creates depth. I don't think that conflict is necessarily a contradiction. It's a black Southern, like, creased kind of depth to me that I think we sort of neglect when we think about that age of black woman who got us here.
Yes, hey, Layman, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
I'm so happy to be with you, Mark, always. Thank you, brother.
All right, everybody, that is our show. Upfront, we'll be back next week.